Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Meat and Three is Heritage Radio Network's weekly food news roundup. This week on Meat and Three, we're bringing you highlights from Feast Portland, like our chat with the one and only Andrew Zimmern.
I'm super excited to be here because for people who do what I do for a living, we do tons of, you know, desk side chats and podcasts and interviews and stuff like that. And you circle the handful of ones in a year where you get to talk with people that you're really excited about talking with. So this is awesome.
We picked up on some recurring themes while talking to our impressive roster of guests, including the current state of Portland's food scene, personal identity, and believe it or not, the influence of great chefs' grandmothers.
Meemaw never touched a drop of booze in her life and now has a distillery named after her. But I grew up in her garden and just really, she taught me all good things come from scratch and women can be anyone they want to be.
So tune in for this week's extra special episode. Subscribe to Meat and Three wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, hello. This is What Doesn't Kill You Food Industry Insights. My name is Katie Kiefer, and this is the Heritage Radio Network. I have a really special treat today. I was lucky enough to be invited to the 20th anniversary Nyman Ranch Hog Farmer Appreciation Dinner. Yes, that's right, folks. The people at Nyman Ranch invite all the farmers who are able to leave the farm and come to Des Moines, Iowa for a fabulous dinner that is essentially catered by some of the great chefs of the United States. And I'm not kidding. Andrea Rusing from Lantern, Charles Fan from Slanted Door. I mean, it was just an all-star lineup. The food was amazing. And this is all in the service of saying a great big loving thank you to the people who raised the hogs for the Nyman Ranch portfolio. So they also have a sort of whole day of wonderful speakers and seminars. And again, lucky enough to attend those. And one of the attendees for those speaking slots was the eminent Fred Kirschenman. Fred has been a longtime hero of mine. He is the author of many books. He is also I think he's emeritus now from the Stone Barns Foundation. But he is also a very present and active at the Leopold Center at Iowa State University, talking, and his work has, over the course of his career, has dealt with all things about sustainability, soil health, and so forth. So without further ado, you will be listening to a pre-recorded interview that I did out in Des Moines with Mr. Kirschenman. It was a true joy to listen to him, and he has some really interesting ideas. I think you'll enjoy this show a lot, and please feel free to send me some feedback either via my Facebook page or on my station page at Heritage Radio Network. Thanks so much and enjoy this show.
I'm speaking today with Fred Kirschenman, who is the Stone Barns. Fred, you introduce yourself.
Well, I have my career at this point is committed to two different organizations. One is the Stone Barns Center for Food and Agriculture out in New York, which is primarily focused on, urban agriculture. Mm-hmm. And then I also, the other half of my time I spend at the Leopold Center at Iowa State University up in Ames. And Leopold Center, of course, is primarily looking at doing research in terms of commodity agriculture and what the future can bring about. So.
Well, funny you should mention that, because yep. that's our first question. Yeah. So when we look at models of sustainability or the future of agriculture, you and I were just talking a minute before about what will happen as we transition out of the fossil fuel age and into essentially a new economy.
Yeah.
How do you see agriculture keeping up with that? Because I don't see any great changes on the horizon.
Yeah, I think that one of the things we have to anticipate, and this is something that, from my perspective, is not yet part of our conversations as much as it should be, and that is we have to recognize that, and ever since we humans have been on the planet, you know, we have fed ourselves in different ways. You know, for the first 190,000 years, we fed ourselves as hunter-gatherers. Then we started to do agriculture, and it was primarily a slash-and-burn kind of agriculture, you know, where we cut down the perennial grasses or trees and then grow some food there. And then in roughly the middle 1800s, we transitioned to a third way of feeding ourselves, and that's this input-intensive system. And that's worked relatively well for, you know, about 100 years because we've had all the cheap inputs. We had cheap fossil fuels. We had cheap rock phosphate from which we got our phosphorus. We had cheap fossil water for our irrigation. And we're depleting all of those resources. And so we're now reaching a point where we're going to transition to our fourth era. And that is an era which, in fact, Ernest Shuster, who wrote about this, called this current era that we're in the neocaloric era, because it's entirely based on old calories. And then he already said a number of years ago that this is going to be a very short period of time. And then we have to think about how we're going to feed ourselves in the post-neocaloric era. And that's the point where we're starting to move into now. So we have to start asking ourselves, if we're currently, and it's not only our food system, it's our whole economy. If our current economy is entirely dependent on all these old inputs, and it's not going to be that we can do it until they're gone, we can do it until the costs get too high. And if you simply look at phosphorus, you know, in the 1960s, farmers were buying phosphorus for $60 a ton. Now it's $700 a ton. And, you know, if you look, and everybody that's been looking at this, we only have four countries that still have rock phosphate reserves. And specialists who've been looking at this, they've been saying that at most we have another 20 years of rock phosphate reserves, and maybe only another 10 years, depending on how rapidly we use them up. So it's not unreasonable to expect that within the next, you know, 10 to 15 years, farmers may have to be paying $2,500 a ton for phosphorus. At what point is that simply not going to work anymore? And again, in terms of our current resources, David Montgomery published a new book recently called Growing a Revolution, in which he points out that there are already farmers who, with this input-intensive system, are realizing that they're losing money. And so they have begun to transition now primarily to a system that does three things. It reduce their tillage. They include cover crops because that restores the health of the soil. And they significantly increase the diversity of their production system so that it isn't dependent on a lot of inputs, because the diversity of the system tends to feed itself.
Right.
And so they're now beginning to make money. And as he points out, every one of these farmers now are no longer interested in getting bigger, because that's not the future. The future is further enhancing the biological dynamics of the system. So we're starting to see these beginnings of these changes. But I think as a culture, and especially as a food and agriculture system, these are conversations we need to start having, and that farmers, it's not just the farmers that have to have these conversations, we all have to have these conversations, because if farmers are going to do the kind of diversity that the farmers in David Montgomery's book are talking about, then we have to diversify the food system.
Yes.
So that the demand for the market, you know, supports what farmers have to do. And so we have to base this on the kind of new kind of relationships. And this is where I think Nyman Ranch, to some extent, is an early example, because
right.
It's based entirely on relationships. This isn't just farmers doing something. You know, this is based on the kinds of relationships that the farmers have with their customers. And the farmers aren't just raw material suppliers. You know, they're part of the system and
Right. Working
those things together.
Well, let's talk for a second a little bit more about the Nyman Ranch model, just
yeah.
because not everybody knows
yeah.
about them,
yeah.
about Nyman Ranch, or what they're doing.
Right.
So can you describe the model that they use and why that's succeeding with their farmers, where
yeah,
other
well,
farmers are struggling?
Yeah, well, first of all, the concept that that farmers are using, where they're not raising meat animals simply by feeding them a lot of grain or, you know, other, you know, which are fairly standard again in the old model.
Right.
But they really feed their animals in a way that the nature that they're dependent upon gets renewed in the process of using it. And so again, it reduces the amount of inputs that they need from outside the farms. The farms become much more self-sustaining. And then they have these relationships with their customers because the quality of the meat which they produce is such that the customers like that, and so they look for their brand. And so, and then again, Niman Ranch is not just interested only in the profits for the company or for the organization, but also for the farmers themselves. So the farmers share in that, so it makes it possible for
them to do that. That's the most revolutionary aspect of Niman Ranch, is that they guarantee a price per pound for their farmers, which is certainly not the case in conventional commodity agriculture.
That's right. That's right.
Actually, across the board, I think, right?
Yeah.
I mean, nobody gets guaranteed a price,
whether
you're a grain farmer or a pig farmer.
Yeah. And even if you just look at agriculture generally now, I just saw a report the other day that it's now anticipated that the prices that farmers in the current commodity agriculture are being paid are going to be down 13% of where it was last year.
And is that because of the tariffs?
Partly because of the tariffs, partly because of, you know, again, the system whereby, you know, farmers have to produce these inputs as cheaply as possible because that's what the industrial system wants.
Yeah.
Because they want to maximize their profits further up the line, so farmers have to hunker down and figure out how to do this. But at some point, it doesn't work, you know.
Well, it's already not working, for example, in the dairy industry, which is collapsing in front of us.
Yeah.
When we were talking about, you know, sustainable models for agriculture in the future, and we were saying that, you know, Niman Ranch represents something that you think is going to be sort of more the model of the future, in the sense that those animals are raised on pasture, right? They don't have, there's no confinement involved in this model. But when you think about how many animals need to be raised in order to, you know, quote unquote, feed the world, as the big, you know, the big players like to say, we don't have enough pasture to do that. So how do we scale that?
Yeah, that's another great question, because, you know, right now, again, in terms of our old culture, we're thinking that whatever the human population is, all we got to do is figure out how to feed them all, right?
Yeah.
Well, if you just look at that situation in terms of our current circumstances, we talk about we have to produce more because we have to feed the world. And but with only a little over 7 billion people, there are about a billion that are going hungry.
Oh, yeah.
And never, but, you know, we're actually producing enough food now to feed between 10 and 12 billion people. And yet we got over a billion going hungry at 7 billion people.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons is because 40% of the food that we produce gets wasted.
Right.
Now, we're beginning to address the waste problem, but that's only a small piece of the problem. You know, the problem is, again, And the larger issue that we have to deal with here is the issue of what my colleagues call the carrying capacity. There is ultimately a limit to how many humans the planet can sustain. And it's not just feeding them, it's the whole, I mean, you know, if the human population, and some of my colleagues have told me this, if the human population continued to grow at the rate that it has for the last, you know, 100 years or so, in another few hundred years, there wouldn't be enough room for people to stand on. So, you know, at some point, you know, we have to recognize this issue. So it's important for us, I think, to begin. And this doesn't mean that, you know, we have to tell people you can't have three kids, you can only have one kid. It's really a matter, primarily, as we're discovering in many parts of the world, well, it's in many, but some parts of the world, is that when you empower women, then the rate of production of human populations goes down. So it's really a matter of, again, kinds of relationships that we have and recognizing what's important in the interest of all of us.
That's right. And so what a box to unpack there. Fred, you're killing me, man.
Yeah.
Well, when we talk about a different economy, that we, the kind of the different economy that we're going to need, and the different agricultural model that we're going to have along with that economy, what do you see that as being?
Well, it's interesting, again, an interesting question, and there is another author that I found inspiring. His name is John Takara.
Oh, I don't know.
And he published a new book about 2 years ago called How to Thrive in the Next Economy. And he writes this book based on his travels around the world. And he's discovered, based on his travels around the world, that there are now people throughout the world that are recognizing that the old economy, the industrial economy, you know, where you produce one or two things in one place and sell them throughout the world, and then you import a lot of what you need in your own economy. And people are beginning to recognize in their own, what he calls bioregions, that that economy is just not working for them anymore.
Yeah.
Because, you know, again, as costs go up and fossil fuel costs go up, et cetera, you know, they don't have the resources to distribute them every and import things. And so they start to ask the question, why don't we feed ourselves? And it isn't just about food, it's about the whole economy. Why don't we sustain ourselves by simply looking at what the resources are within our own bioregions, and then how do we use those resources in a way that they get renewed in the process of using them, so it becomes a kind of self-sustaining. And he claims that this kind of culture is already emerging in many, many parts of the world. And there are actually not many places, but a couple of places in the United States where this is beginning to happen now. So I think we're going to see, again, these kinds of transitions take place. And so we're not going to have, you know, Iowa, for example, just producing corn and soybeans and pork and whatever and distributing that throughout the world. We're going to be looking at Iowa in terms of the resources that we have in Iowa and how do we use those resources in a way that they get renewed in the process of using them. And then Dakara makes an interesting point. He says that the concept of growth in these new cultures now is no longer about unlimited economic growth. Growth now is about how do we renew life on Earth. And that's a great concept.
That's a wonderful concept. Yeah, yeah. Sounds like Dr. John Eichert.
Yeah. Yeah.
As well.
Yeah.
But, you know, in our greedy corporate globalist culture, you know, it's really a stretch for me to imagine people backing away from the idea of maximizing their profits.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to suggest at all that this is a transition that's going to happen very quickly and very easily and everybody will do it. But I'm not predicting the future here. I'm simply anticipating the kinds of changes that we're likely to have. And, you know, there have been a number of people now who have looked at past civilizations, and Jared Diamond being one of them, in which he discovered that, you know, those civilizations which anticipated the changes coming at them and got a head start preparing for them were the ones that tended to thrive. Those that failed in that exercise were the ones that tended to collapse. So, you know, we may have some collapses taking place I think the good news is, and it's not a lot of good news, but it's good news in the sense that there are some major companies now that are beginning to recognize that they can't just continue doing what they're doing.
Yeah.
You know, General Mills being one of them. You know, I think they still need to make a lot more changes than they're currently considering. But nevertheless, they are realizing that they can't just continue to produce, you know, a lot of stuff that people are going to buy, and then they can just, you know, rake in the cash and continue doing what they're doing. It's not what the, and especially the millennial generation now, and I don't want to, again, be too enthusiastic about where they are, but at least those young people in their 30s and under 30s that I'm working with, I'm very inspired by, because, you know, they're no longer interested in producing a lot of economies. They want to produce food for people, and they want to do that in a way that it meets the needs of the people that they're working with. And so there's some changes taking place that are positive.
I think so. I think in a way that the Trump era, which I equate with Kardashian and, you know, super consumption and focus on the trivial and the shallow. I do think that kids are really kind of fed up with that, and that there's a sense of wanting to reclaim something more valuable about existence.
Yeah, in fact, some of my colleagues are telling me that Trump's going to make a major contribution because it's so bad that
that's what I'm thinking.
It takes more quickly.
I totally think that. And I also think, like, I mean, in a way, because he was, there were so many people in the Midwest and so much of the farming community supported the Trump, what they thought was the Trump agenda.
Yeah.
And now they're finding out that it's really not their agenda at all.
Yeah.
I think that that is also going to make a sea change amongst this population, which I think is kind of traditionally difficult to move along.
Yeah.
I think farmers, you know, their life is so risky.
Yeah.
Their livelihood is so risky to start with that. Yeah.
And especially if their income goes down 13% this the coming year, they're going to be
And it's not like it's been growing over the last
right.
4 or 5 years. I mean, I think the boom years for many grain farmers anyway was in the 2006 and 7 before the crash and before grain prices spiked up to you know, whatever they were, $9, $10 a bushel for corn.
Yeah.
I think that that's, you know, this is all going to change.
Yeah.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
When we talk about moving into the future, though, like besides sort of changing, sort of re-regionalizing the food system, which is what you're suggesting, I wonder about that a little bit, just because the, you know, the grain belt of the United States is the grain belt, and it really is best suited to grow grain.
Yeah.
And I remember speaking to somebody from the, I think the American Farm Trust, is that the right?
Yeah.
The American Farm Trust, who was saying that really it would be very difficult to change the model.
Yeah.
Just because A, of the quality of the land, is that's what it's suited for, and also the infrastructure that goes with that is in place, and the infrastructure for, say, growing fruits and vegetables really is not.
Yeah.
Not to mention that the growing season is so much shorter.
Yeah.
And I wonder how we would you know, how do we make that work instead of make it
Well, again, I think we have to look at this in terms of the model that we've created was really designed to support this industrial economy, you know, where you produce a few things in one place and then make them available throughout the world. But, you know, I just learned about this a couple of years ago. 70% of the world's people today are fed by farmers farming 5 acres or less.
Wow.
70% of the world's people. So we like to claim that we're feeding the world. But in point of fact, you know, what we're producing here in Iowa doesn't feed the world. In fact, Iowa imports about 50% of the food that it consumes from outside of Iowa.
Sure.
Now, if we were to really have this kind of regionalized food system where we produced most of the food that we eat ourselves in Iowa, then, you know, we wouldn't be producing all of these commodities. And that, but that doesn't mean that, because the commodities that we produce aren't feeding 70% of the world's population. No, it's feeding a much
smaller. They're feeding animals.
That's right. They're feeding animals. They're feeding.
And ethanol.
Yeah, they're feeding energy, et cetera. And so, again, as the system starts to change, and, you know, again, there are some farmers even here in Iowa that are no longer so energy intensive. You know, Ron Roseman, who has a farm near Harlan, Iowa, he has not purchased any nitrogen since 1980 on his farm because he doesn't need it, because the system which he has, you know, generates its own nitrogen for, you know, with the animals he has, et cetera. So, you know, as we start to do that, then, you know, the demand for producing more corn and more soybeans in Iowa are going to start to go down, and farmers are going to need to start. And this is already starting to happen in some you know, especially farmers who are part of organizations like Practical Farmers of Iowa, for example, most of them are much more diversified than just raising one or two commodities.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, the system becomes more self-renewing and self-regulating, and so it's so they make a better profit by that kind of diversity. So again, this is not a change that's going to happen in 2 or 3 years. It's going to be more like, you know, 30 to 40 years, maybe 50 years.
Yeah.
But as the changes take place, you know, this and again, it's already to some extent taking place. And again, you know, if we're currently 70% of the world's population are being fed by farmers farming 5 acres or less, then it's going to be, you know, smaller farms that are part of the community and are producing the kind of food that people in the community want and need. And you start to have this, you know, the deterioration, maybe that's the wrong word, but at least the reduction of the kind of huge commodity agriculture. You know, farmer Earl Butz, one of our secretaries of agriculture,
yes,
said,
under Nixon,
you know, farmers had to get bigger, get out, and
that's
farm fence row to fence row. And of course, that's what farmers have done, quite understandably.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the future now.
Right, right. Yeah. You mentioned earlier your interest in urban agriculture. And I feel like when you talk about farming, you know, 70% of the world is fed on 5 acres or less, urban farming is a wonderful example of that,
yeah,
because certainly that is, in some cities, is definitely thriving.
Yeah, I do think that's right, and we're starting to see, you know, there are within New York City, for example, there are, I think it's something like 20,000 acres that could be used for producing food.
Mm.
But here's the other thing that, you know, there are increasingly now, there are, And Richard Heinberg has written about this for a number of years, what he calls the re-ruralization of America. And his vision is that the movement of farmers out of rural communities into urban areas to work in factories, etc., to meet the needs of the industrial economy, that's what caused the unsettling of America. But as that economy begins to disappear, and then, you know, people are going, and again, I've seen some of this even here in Iowa, where young people are now moving back to rural communities, and because they want to grow their own food, et cetera, and they can do that more readily than they can in large cities, and so they move back into Iowa. So again, this is only the very early beginnings of, but I think that Heinberg has been right, that the re-ruralification of America is something which will be happening again over the next 30 to 40 years.
I certainly hope so. And then let's finish up with, what do you think about the Farm Bill?
Yeah.
Speaking of.
Yeah. If the Farm Bill is, Wes Jackson has been for a long time been arguing that the way we're doing the Farm Bill doesn't get us where we need to go.
Right.
And he created the concept of the 50-year Farm Bill, that what we should, instead of only trying to figure out what we're going to do for the next 5 years, which always makes it political, that he said, if what we should do is think about, where do we want to be 50 years from now, and then backcast from that, what do we need to do every 5 years to get to where we want to be 50 years from now?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a great concept, but of course, in our culture, that's still not the way people want to do things. But I do think that what we're already starting to see this a little bit, and that is, again, that while Wes's approach for doing this as a policy issue hasn't worked, it's going to work as an economic issue.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've now seen, for example, predictions which people have put together. And again, predictions are, you know, things can always change. But, you know, again, anticipating changes, this could be happening, in which, you know, people are now saying that, you know, as the cost of annual grains goes up because of all the things we just talked about, then you can't feed all the animals grains anymore.
Right.
You're going to feed more of those animals on grasses. And this last summer, I was asked to speak at a conference for a grass-fed organization out in the western edge of South Dakota. And so I drove out on I-90 as I drove out. And the last 250 miles of getting to the western South Dakota, on every side of the highway, there were grasslands with animals on them. And these were areas that you would think they would be raising corn and soybeans because that's been the tradition. But obviously, farmers are beginning to recognize that they're, given the costs of raising the corn and soybeans and the returns they get isn't working for them as well as turning it back into perennial grasses and raising animals. So I think you're going to see a decrease of annual grains. Hopefully, if some of the research that the Land Institute's been doing in terms of perennial grains, we'll see an increase in perennial grains. Mm-hmm. But the real increase is going to come in grasslands. And again, you can say, well, but we're not going to have enough meat just raising it on grasslands. But again, in terms of where we are with the human population and what we're eating, and how we're, putting our food system together when we start to look at our own resources and our own bioregions, I think that increasing on a percentage basis, the number of grasslands will increase over the next 50 years.
And I think people are more tuned into the idea of feeding animals on grass rather than keeping them in confinement.
And also the quality. I mean, people right now are paying a significant premium to have grass-fed beef.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also I think that the trend for eating meat in this country is kind of flat.
Yeah.
And I think that unfortunately it's rising around the world, especially in developing countries where meat was a scarcity and it's a luxury and it's a status symbol. But I think here in this country...
Well, one of the things I've always said when people tell me that we eat too much meat, I tell them, I don't eat as much meat now as I did when I was 5 years old.
True.
Because when I was 5 years old, my mother produced all of the food on our table, and she produced the food primarily from what we were growing on our own farm up there in North Dakota.
Yeah.
And so I can't remember her ever putting a plate of food in front of me from the time I was 5 years old that didn't have meat on it. Well, I don't eat meat on every plate anymore, So it's not that we eat more meat. I think it's that there's more of us on the planet that are eating meat. And so, again, we need to find that balance. I'm not an expert in terms of health issues, but, a lot of the information that I've seen of people that have really looked at this, that eating meat is, it's not eating meat that has a negative health effect on us, it's the kind of meat that you eat that can have a negative effect on your health. But this is where I think that, one of the reasons that people are willing to pay a premium price for Niman Ranch meat is because of the quality of that meat and the whole benefits that they see from that being a part of that system and a part of that culture.
Well, and what also is interesting about Niman Ranch to me is that they're a little bit more expensive.
Yeah.
But they're not, it's not like going to a farmer's market and spending $25 on a chicken.
Right.
Like, I get that it costs, It's like, to me, that's prohibitive.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if I'm going to spend, $8 on a pound of bacon, I'd rather spend $10 on a pound of Niman Ranch bacon. Because that's what that, there's your price differential.
That's right,
So, the fact that they've been able to scale it in a way that keeps it at a consumer-friendly price point, I think is the most important aspect of their success.
And that's, again, where scale does have an impact. If you're an individual CSA producer and you've got a small market, then you have to try to make that work, and so you have to get a price that enables you to make it work. But if you're part of a community of farmers who are doing the same thing with their own brand like Niman Ranch, then you have the scale that enables you to find a price differential that serves the farmers and their needs well, but also meets the needs of the consumers that buy your product.
So, well, I hope it does become the model that takes over.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty optimistic about that. I think that, I'm not necessarily suggesting that Niman Ranch has the answers to everything, and I don't think that, I think Paul Willis would be the first person, at least that what he has said to me too. And they also see that they need to continue to Anticipate future changes and how they respond to those. But the model, the idea, the concept, the culture that they're developing in Niman Ranch has so many of the important things that are going to be the future of our food system.
Yeah, I think so. Well, Fred, thank you so, so much for this. This has been a wonderful conversation. I've
My
really
pleasure.
Enjoyed it.
My
really
pleasure,
have.
Kylie. Yeah.
And thanks to Niman Ranch for helping make this happen.
Yes, absolutely.
You've been listening to Fred Kirschenman, who is the emeritus fellow at the Stone Barns Foundation in New York, as well as a professor at the Leopold Center at Iowa State University. He's the author of many books, and he was kind enough to spend this time with me at the Niman Ranch Hog Farmer Appreciation Dinner. I really loved the ideas that he expressed, particularly about the end of what he calls the neocaloric era. I thought his ideas were really interesting, and I'm hoping that he will be continuing to expound and expand upon them as the years roll by. But for now, that's the end of this show, and thanks so much for listening, and thanks to my sponsor.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please, join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.